Welcome to Trailblazers, where we explore the journeys of remarkable leaders who are making an impact in our region and around the world. Today's guest has built success in business, fought for justice in policy, and brought urgent societal issues to the screen. Richard Master, founder and chairman of MCS Industries, North America's leading supplier of picture frames and decorative mirrors and building products, has a career that stretches far beyond manufacturing. From his early days in the U.S. Department of Justice's Civil Rights Division, to building a thriving business, to producing acclaimed documentaries on healthcare reform, and most recently, the $238 million apartment, Richard has consistently used his platform to spark meaningful change. His latest film exposes the staggering wealth gap in America, challenging us to rethink what the American dream really means. Today, we'll talk about the pivots, the risks, the lessons, and the values that have defined his journey. Richard, thanks so much for joining us today.
I appreciate the welcome and look forward to our dialogue.
Yeah, absolutely. So, Richard, for the listeners, bring us back a little bit. Tell us, before MCS became a household name, your career began in a very different arena, law, and specifically the Civil Rights Division of the U.S. Department of Justice. How did that experience shape the leader you became? Walk us through that a little bit.
Yeah, well, we have to go pretty far back. It was 1970 when I joined the Justice Department. I was a recent grad from Columbia University School of Law.
Oh, cool.
I spent a year as a VISTA volunteer in Washington and then took a job as a trial attorney in the Justice Department. I was in the housing section, and we were responsible 2 years after the passage of the Fair Housing Act, 1968, we were responsible for administering and actually defining from a judicial standpoint. You know, you have a basic law, and then the court system interprets that law, and we wanted it to be interpreted more aggressively. The law was kind of modest in its execution. So we started doing that. I was with a bunch of brilliant attorneys, and we started doing that across the country.
And what did you find in those early days, like, you know, just getting into law and to a degree politics, you know?
Yes. Well, what I found was that politics really ultimately interferes with justice and also with the application of law. And that's the reason why I resigned with a group of other attorneys in protest, because a major case involving Coldwell Banker in California was settled at the attorney general level rather than in the department that we were in. And I think the White House was also involved in that. There were cronies, and we were concerned about that, and we held a press conference and left the department.
That was bold. Now, how long were you there for? What year was then?
That was probably just the early stages, probably mid-1972, and then I started working for the McGovern for President campaign.
Okay.
So, and I spent 6-7 months doing that, which was very interesting, but remarkably compelling in terms of time.
I bet.
And really challenging for our family at that point.
Oh, yeah, for sure. So then did you leave D.C. at that point and come back to the Lehigh Valley?
Well, and then I established a litigation practice with three other lawyers in Washington. And I had a crew there. In 1973, my father passed away. My father had a small paper box factory. It was called the Easton Box Company. At that point, it was, you know, four doors down from a charcoal pit bar, you know, on Butler Street at Easton.
Okay.
And it was the support for my mother. And so I would spend some time in the Lehigh Valley. I would go back and forth between Washington, D.C. and the Lehigh Valley, keeping that company going, and it started to grow. we grew. And interesting, along the way, I would be driving up, and there were a number of box factories that were closing down and selling equipment. And I would go to those factories, and I would buy their equipment. And ultimately, we ran out of space.
Oh, my gosh.
On Butler Street. And the big break for us, the thing that really sort of transformed my business career at that point was of the Eastern National Bank had a mortgage that was underwater in West Easton. It was the Chipman Knitting Mills, a few hundred thousand square feet of sort of
light industrial space?
Yeah, industrial space that was somewhat challenging for people to occupy. And we embraced that, and that led to MCS Industries.
I see.
Yeah, because we had extra space, and we had power and water, and it led to the establishment of
an equipment, right, that you were able to acquire from other facilities closing shop, essentially, which was kind of a blessing, right?
Yeah, and then we built an Easton Box Company, but we established an injection molding plant, which led to the development of our own brands of picture frames, which we sold into the marketplace. In those days, there were Photoshops and there were all kinds of stores, stationery stores,
sure,
that would be carrying picture frames and frame shops. And
I'm old enough to remember the times when you used to be able to even take a Polaroid picture, or you know, just a 35mm camera, and have it printed, and you want to frame it, right?
Right.
Now
right.
Everything's digital, but it was quite different back then.
Yeah. So we took the sort of philosophy of the box factory, where we were beginning to automate, and we had some vertical integration, and we applied that into the frame industry, which was really highly stratified with different profit centers and raw material suppliers, et cetera. And when we did that, we were a very competitive supplier into that marketplace.
And was there any particular big break, if you will, that kind of not just took you completely out of D.C., right? Like, no longer in politics, but, you know, running this company full-time and really kind of set the trajectory for what was to come for MCS as, you know, the industry that it is today?
Yeah, I think by 1978, I realized that this was, the business was just growing at remarkable rates, 30 to 40% a year, and I had to really make a decision. And I relocated to and lived in Easton, which was my home as a child, and continued to develop MCS. It was the right choice to make. But I certainly enjoyed being a lawyer and doing the work that we were doing in Washington as well.
Did you feel any level of risk, and how did you embrace that? Going from, you know, law to manufacturing in a hometown that maybe doesn't have as much as a presence at that time, at least, as D.C. did?
I didn't really feel uncertainty. And throughout my life, I haven't been so concerned about those issues, those personal issues. I thought it was my role. I had been trained at the Wharton School. In business, it was my role to organize capital and labor and efficiently make products. That was a job that I did, and I enjoyed.
Yeah, absolutely.
So it was almost like playing in a sandbox as a child.
Yeah.
but with a higher stakes, you know?
Absolutely. So you were the founder and the chairman, right?
That's right. At this point, I'm the chairman. I was the CEO.
Okay. But you've led MCS for decades at this point, right?
Of course.
And what would you say is the core of your leadership philosophy coming through all of that?
I think, you know, at the core is integrity. It's really at the core of pretty much everything that I'm hope to be about. Integrity of product, you know, integrity with relationships, mm-hmm. With our employees and associates and our customers. I mean, you know, you have to want and understand what is in the best interest of everyone associated with you. I think that's important. Certainly, efficiency is another really important thing. Mm-hmm. You've got to get things done. You have to be agile in this world, particularly now when conditions are changing.
Yeah.
Particularly, you know, in the years we have right now. I mean, it's a whirlwind. And I'm very concerned about the economy at this point. You know, these are major considerations and preparation, although you don't want to overly aim. You really want to get ready and shoot.
Mm-hmm.
Don't hesitate in this environment. You've got to be able to make decisions relatively quickly, or you're going to be lost in the wave.
Yeah, absolutely. So is there any challenge that you faced that you mentioned being agile? Was there any challenge that you faced that taught you a lesson or perhaps defined how you approach things, and what leadership, you know, legacy would you want to share with other leaders out there?
The challenges, you know, are different I think for the first years, let's say 1970 to 2005, we followed a sort of a business theory of increasing vertical integration in the manufacturing of our product.
Mm-hmm.
So where our competitors would buy component parts and assemble them, that was their job. It was just to assemble and distribute. We made those component parts. We established an aluminum extrusion plant to make an aluminum extrusion profile.
Mm.
We were making wood profiles in our Mexico operation. You know, we had a printing operation as well, a sophisticated printing operation. That allowed us to develop a high level of capacity, but also to cut the profit centers between us and also the lead times. But in 2005, what was going on was internationalization.
Mm.
Regardless of our efficiencies, it was very challenging for us to compete with products produced in the Orient.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, we were in China in the very early stages of China's transformation into a modern manufacturing behemoth, really.
Mm-hmm.
I can remember the first time I was in China, we had a trading company in Hong Kong. This is an aside story, if you don't mind.
Sure.
So, and I said, we are interested in going into the People's Republic of China and seeing what the opportunities are. And the Hong Kong agent said, well, okay, you bring two bottles of Johnny Walker Red. You fly into Shanghai Airport. At that time, Shanghai Airport had maybe 10 gates. It was a very small airport. And we'll get to a factory that wants to make picture frames. I flew in.
Walker in hand? Or no?
Johnny Walker in hand, of course. I follow instructions, you know, always. We ended up in a train that took 5 hours to get to a town called Suzhou. We got to the town. We went to a Chinese musical instrument factory, and we sat down, and the Johnny Walker labels came out. You know, the whiskey came out.
Yeah.
We had this massive dinner where the Communist Party was there, the boss, the general. There must have been 15 people around the table. And I had to toast. I've never been so drunk in my life. Well, today, Suzhou is one of the sophisticated manufacturing centers for electronics in the world. There is a bullet train that goes from Shanghai to Suzhou in probably 30 minutes. And people go up to Suzhou to have dinner. From Shanghai to have dinner around a beautiful lake that they developed. I mean, it's incredible what happened in, let's say, the space of 25, 30 years in China. And it transformed, in many respects, American manufacturing.
Interestingly enough, in that instance, you were able to not just use the integrity that you have in manufacturing and your leadership and everything, all the sales and everything that you have from a manufacturing perspective. But I imagine you had to use a little politics too, right?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, we had to. You have to build relationships.
Oh, yeah.
And we have developed some really wonderful friendships with people.
But did that meeting make things a little bit easier from that perspective as far as, you know, the business that you were doing there?
Yeah, I mean, you know, we got back from that first trip. We had ordered 2 containers of frames. We opened up the containers in the United States. The product was substandard. It was so terrible that we sent it over to the furnaces. But so you really had to establish a quality control and negotiation position and all that expertise. And we did. And it was, for a while, it was very, very significant for our company.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. So let's shift gears here a little bit.
Okay.
Your foray into filmmaking began with healthcare documentaries, right? So you're in your manufacturing. You pivot to filmmaking. How did you get into that? What made you decide to use film as your next platform? Because you've been a change maker, right? Like injustice and, doing different things from the manufacturing perspective. Walk us through that a little bit. And how did you become a filmmaker?
Well, it started with really a runaway expense at MCS. You know, we had hundreds of employees in the United States. At one point, we had 600-700 employees in the United States. We had 600-700 employees in Mexico, and we had thousands of employees that were in China. We understood in Mexico we had a doctor and nurses in the plant, and we provided primary care, primary care, right? And we would accompany people to the hospital to make sure they were getting care for their more acute care. And it was modest in cost. In the United States, the cost of insuring an employee was one of the fastest, if not the fastest growing expense on an annual basis.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I've always been concerned about public policy. I come from a family of doctors. My brother's a doctor. Mm-hmm. My uncle, you know, my cousins are doctors. And, you know, I've been privy to all their conversations and their concerns. And so I started turning over the rocks of the healthcare system to see, you know, what was causing these massive increases. And that then led to, you know, there was a lot of research being done. I had people helping me as well, you know, and then Vince Mondillo, who's a close friend of mine, was the a director, movie maker for the Discovery Channel and did a whole bunch of biographies with Lou Rita. I don't know if you remember that group. He came on board and we planned the first one, which was Fix It, Healthcare at the Tipping Point, which profiled the concerns and also how, of course, the economics were always of great interest to me, how the system is financed.
Mm-hmm.
That was a very successful project, and it led to the second movie, which was, you know, really an investigation of the pharmaceutical industry. It was called Big Pharma Market Failure because the market dynamics were ineffective. The rules of supply and demand were ineffective to discipline price of pharmaceutical drugs
mm-hmm.
in the country. It's runaway. And we're paying 2 to 5 times more than other countries are paying for the same drugs because we just lack regulation. that led to the third movie, which really, it was called The Big Money Agenda, and Democracy at the Brink was the tag for that. It really profiled how the healthcare sector was lobbying in Washington to really control national healthcare policy. They are the biggest lobbyists. They spend the most money. And it's of real concern. I think our level of care is great, but we're really inefficient. The system is inefficient, and we're certainly utilizing so much of our GDP for our economic value for healthcare, and certainly we're not getting the best results.
When you made this pivot, and you kind of went back to policy advocacy, like the work that you were doing early on in your career,
right?
And you had taken this leadership role in manufacturing, and then you did this creative, these creative projects. How did that feel to you? Like, was that more about your passion from a policy advocacy perspective, or would you say that was more, a creative pursuit that you wanted to embrace that kind of helped you to breathe in certain ways, to use a platform like filmmaking in order to be able to get across vital information?
Well, yeah, I guess all of the above would be the simple answer. It felt like it was the right and righteous thing for me to do.
Right.
Be doing with whatever talents I have. There is a real community concern about this, and not enough people in the business community are addressing it.
Yeah.
We're the ones who ensure, 50% of the population in the United States, the business community, through commercial insurers. We're paying 2.5 times what Medicare is paying for the same procedure.
Mm-hmm.
There's just a lot of very odd things about our system here that really need identification and correction.
Mm-hmm.
And I felt, if not me, who's going to do this?
Yeah. The latest project, the $238 million apartment. Why did this story and this symbol of the, it deals with wealth disparity, resonate so strongly with you? And what was the most surprising or sobering discovery that you made while producing the documentary?
Yeah.
Why this project and why now?
Interesting question. Well, I think the major concern that we have in the United States is the rising political instability here, the deterioration of what it is to be middle class. And, we have a pastor in this movie who he's running a food distribution center, a pickup center, and the cars are lined up way down the street.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, a lot of these people are from the middle class. And he said, what does middle class mean now? It's another name for working poor. Mm. We have a deteriorating middle class. It used to be that 70-80% of working people could participate in the American dream, which is to buy a house at
mm-hmm.
least
mm-hmm.
and to be able to educate your kids. It's now 30%.
That American dream has really changed over time.
And we can see it here in the Lehigh Valley area. Housing prices are so high. Young people just emerging into the workforce don't believe that they're going to do as well as their parents,
mm-hmm.
which is also part of the American dream. And some of us are prospering greatly. If you look at the top 1% of earners in the United States, they have 50% of stock market wealth. The top 10% have over 90%. It's closer to 93-94%. The bottom 50% have 2%, 2-3% of stock market wealth. So there is no wealth. in the lower middle class, and certainly in people who have very little. And it's a concern, because that leads, I mean, there has never been a society that has this level of inequity, you know, of distribution.
Mm-hmm.
And there is a concern, and we're actually reducing this social safety net at this point, because we're not raising enough money in taxation. We're lowering taxes, of course. It's just bad policy. Sort of a growing unrest, you know, throughout the society. People just aren't making it, you know. And we can't have that. So we're either a society like ours, and in the movie, we Ray Dalio is one of the brilliant multi-billionaire hedge fund managers, speaks about this. He wrote a book called The Changing World Order, and he thinks we're in the fourth stage, of decline of the American empire, because there is a massive amount of social unrest. We see an increase in repression to control that unrest, and a massive amount of debt. And at some point, there is really a concern of the deterioration of the dollar. We're seeing it. We've lost really almost 10% of the dollar's value over the last 6 months.
What is it that you hope audiences will do after seeing the film? And what legacy do you want to offer, not just those that are recipients, essentially, of this message, but also of leaders in general?
You know, I'm a relatively wealthy person. People like me should realize their responsibility. Many of us are educated and sophisticated in economics. What distinguishes our wealth from wealthy people in other countries is not so much the level of inequity, initial inequity, it's the taxation that is incurred by wealthy people in the United States. It's relatively low, and it should not be. We could afford a robust safety net. We could have housing incentives for folks, and we could restore the American dream. We can have universal health care, or at least access. We're concerned now in the Lehigh Valley. We have community health centers that are federally supported that are going to lose significant sums of money. All this stuff, I'm sort of digressing a little too much. I'm sorry. I get very impassioned about this. But, yeah, we need to increase taxation on income among the wealthy class.
And to use your platform for good.
And
sure.
That's right.
Yeah.
That's right. And people have to realize that. And a number of very significant, you know, billionaires are coming out in favor of this because they're concerned about political stability. I'm concerned about that. I want my family to be safe. But there is a fun aspect of this movie. And that's Toby Hubner's experience. You know, he's really an extraordinary guy. Also a Wharton School graduate, but he became a filmmaker.
He's also the filmmaker for the $238 million apartment. So,
yeah.
And we hope our listeners will definitely tune in. And where can they find that then?
Random Media is our distributor. Mm-hmm. Random Media now will be announcing the platforms where it will be screened.
Okay.
I don't think we're going to have a very broad theatrical release across the country. It's not that kind of movie, but it will be on major platforms, and we'll be announcing that shortly.
Awesome. Richard, you are more than a business leader, and you're more than a filmmaker. You're actually a living reminder that leadership is about what you build and also about what you fight for. From boardrooms to movie screens, you've used your voice to challenge complacency and champion justice. And your work asks us to see the world clearly, but also to imagine it better. Thank you for framing, no pun intended, perhaps, today's conversation with such clarity and passion. And to our listeners, the frame may be set, but the picture is still ours to paint. Yeah, Richard,
absolutely.
Thanks again.
Hey, thanks so much for this opportunity.
Absolutely. Thanks so much.
This was great.
I'm your host, Melody Bradford.